Iran's parliament speaker says Tehran is determined to fully implement a recent law to increase the country's nuclear activities aimed at removing anti-Iran sanctions. A team of World Health Organization experts leaves quarantine in the Chinese city of Wuhan to begin a probe into the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic. And hundreds of Rohingya are reported missing from a refugee camp in Indonesia and are believed to have been trafficked to neighboring Malaysia. Hello and welcome, everybody. Iran's parliament speaker says Tehran is determined to fully implement a recent law to increase the country's nuclear activities aimed at removing anti-Iran sanctions.
Our enemies have already realized and must know that we are determined to implement this law until we see the full removal of sanctions. Of course, this nuclear industry helps us to take our main step, which is neutralizing the sanctions.
Aliyev said the implementation of the strategic action plan is within the framework of the 2015 nuclear deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Aliyev noted that the law has left the door open for Iran's return to full compliance once other signatories fully abide by their JCPOA obligations, including the removal of all anti-Iran sanctions. The top parliamentarian made the remarks during a visit to the Fordow nuclear facility. He also criticized the other signatories to the accord for failing to live up to their commitments. Political commentator Barry Grossman says not only the United States, but all signatories to the nuclear accord, especially the Europeans, violated the terms of the agreement and left Iran alone.
Not in breach of the JCPOA, bearing in mind that it wasn't a unilateral treaty. It was a treaty with multiple signatories, each of which had obligations. And applying basic principles, since all of the other signatories, not just the United States, I might add, but the European signatories as well, have essentially breached both their obligations and their subsequent commitments in the case of European countries to find a way forward, that would seem to open the way for Iran to increase its enrichment activities. As for Iran, let's be perfectly clear about this. All of the decision makers, all of the people responsible for assessing Iran's compliance were of the same opinion, namely that Iran was in full compliance with the JCPOA until, of course, the other signatories completely abandoned their obligations, which in turn freed Iran up to implement these measures that we're now seeing it take now. What Iran intends to do with that increased output of enriched uranium is, of course, anyone's guess. It certainly would be free to sell that uranium to other countries that are signatories to the Non-Proliferation Treaty.
The Iranian foreign minister says it is the United States that should return to its obligations under the 2015 Iran nuclear deal first. In a tweet, Mohammad Javad Zarif said Washington violated the nuclear agreement, prevented supplies of food and medicines to Iran, and punished countries which abided by UN Security Council Resolution 2231. On the other hand, he added, Iran complied with the nuclear deal. Zarif's reaction came after U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Washington will return to the agreement only when Tehran goes back to full compliance with the accord. Former U.S. President Donald Trump pulled out of the deal in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Tehran. In return, Iran scaled back its commitments under the deal, citing the remaining signatories' failure to uphold their end of the bargain. And a team of the World Health Organization experts has begun a probe into the origin of COVID-19 in the Chinese city of Wuhan after leaving their two-week quarantine. The WHO teams wants to know how the virus that has claimed over 2 million lives appeared and spread worldwide. They were also investigating how the virus jumped from animals to humans. The team arrived on January the 14th in Wuhan, where the first known cluster of virus cases emerged in December 2019. The virus is believed to be originated from bats and initially spread from a wet market in Wuhan, where wild animals were sold as food. Our correspondent in Beijing, Stephen Rebay, says it's very hard for the World Health Organization to be impartial in its investigation because the pandemic has been politicized.
The WHO should be sticking to the agenda, its own agenda, which should be, as you say, to find out where this came from and how it spread initially. And it's because this whole thing has been so politicized right from the word go, that is going to be very hard to do. For example, the America, as I said, has been trying to muster a coalition to blame China for this whole thing. It's also been leaking information, misinformation, that it came from a virology, the Wuhan Virology Institute, even though there is broad agreement among experts, so that's very unlikely. And there's even been misinformation that China released this deliberately as a weapon. China has responded with its own campaigns of misinformation.
Germany is preparing entry restrictions for travelers from Britain, Brazil, and South Africa amid growing concerns of more contagious coronavirus variants. According to the Interior Ministry, the new rules are being discussed with the government. Meanwhile, Germany's health ministry announced it expects the current shortage of coronavirus vaccines to continue. Well into April, the health minister said he wanted to call a summit of federal and regional leaders to discuss vaccinations. The death toll from the virus in Germany has crossed 55,000. The overall number of infections stands at nearly 2,180,000. Hundreds of Rohingya have reportedly disappeared from a refugee camp in northern Indonesia. Local officials in the city of Luksamavay say only 112 refugees from nearly 400 have remained at the makeshift camp. Indonesian authorities and the UN say they do not know the whereabouts of the missing refugees, adding that they might have been trafficked to neighboring Malaysia. The refugees had arrived in Indonesia last year. Members of the stateless minority group have long faced discrimination in Myanmar. They've been denied freedom of movement and citizenship and lack access to work, health care, and schools. Nearly a million of them crossed into neighboring Bangladesh after Myanmar's military launched a brutal crackdown in 2017. The UN has described the plight of Rohingya as a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. The United States has temporarily frozen planned arms sales to the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia for review. A State Department spokesperson said the move is aimed at ensuring the sales meet Washington's strategic objectives with regard to its partners. The frozen deals include a $23 billion package of F-35 jets to the UAE. Former U.S. President Donald Trump's administration agreed to the deal after the UAE normalized its relations with Israel. The U.S. has also been preparing major sales of munitions to Saudi Arabia. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said in his Senate confirmation session that the Saudi onslaught on Yemen has contributed to the dire humanitarian situation in the country. Political analyst Brian Terrero says the U.S. is concerned about its own strategic objectives rather than the lives of Yemenis.
Well, I think this is very positive change that we have a president now who understands that the COVID-19 pandemic and climate change are real things, need to be dealt with. But what we're seeing is a return to normal, and as reassuring as that might be, we need to remember how bad normal was, and that this war in Yemen began under the Obama administration when President Biden was Vice President of the United States. I'm concerned over Secretary Blinken's saying that it's advances to our strategic objectives that this review is going to be based on. And not consideration for the people of Yemen who are facing humanitarian disaster that Mr. Blinken is talking about as well. This is, in the United States, the big arms manufacturers like Lockheed Martin and Raytheon, they don't just follow U.S. policies, they make them.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says Washington rejects Beijing's maritime claims in the South China Sea beyond what is permitted under international law. Blinken pledged to stand with Southeast Asian claimants in the face of China's pressure. He made the remarks in a call with Philippine Foreign Minister Teodoro Loxin. China claims almost all of the energy-rich South China Sea, which is also a major trade route. The Philippines, Brunei, Vietnam, Malaysia, and Taiwan have overlapping claims. China has time and again accused the U.S. of interference and increasing tensions in the region. Independent geopolitical analyst Brian Berletic says the U.S. view about international law is hypocritical.
most of this started under the Obama-Biden administration. It only heated up under the Trump administration, but it's going to continue now that Biden is U.S. president, because this is all being driven by a singular U.S. foreign policy to encircle and contain China. And this has been ongoing for many years, you could even say decades, and this latest leg of it is also going to absolutely continue under Biden. And as a matter of fact, everything that we hear the now new U.S. Secretary of State saying about the South China Sea is just an echo of Mike Pompeo from the last 4 years about, you know, China overstepping its bounds and the U.S. backing Southeast Asian countries. It's also very difficult for nations here in the region, again, including nations the U.S. claims it's championing for. It's very difficult for them to take the U.S.'s involvement seriously and see it as sincere assistance and not just a pretext for the U.S. to maintain what it itself calls in all of its policy papers its desire to establish primacy over Asia. The United States is not an Asian nation, so why is it seeking primacy in Asia? This is very problematic, and of course it's very hypocritical when we're talking about international law and even international norms.
Hundreds of people have been injured as the northern Lebanese city of Tripoli witnesses a third consecutive night of protests against a strict coronavirus lockdown. Lebanese media reported that 226 protesters and security forces were injured during the clashes. Security personnel fired tear gas and used water cannon to disperse the angry crowd of mostly youth who threw rocks and set garbage bins on fire in Tripoli's main square. Lebanese people are frustrated with the tight coronavirus restrictions. The government imposed a full round-the-clock lockdown earlier this month in order to curb the spike in COVID-19 cases. The pandemic has exacerbated the country's already crippling economic crisis. Our Beirut correspondent Mariam Saleh says the mob tried to take over police headquarters during protests in the northern Lebanese city of Tripoli.
We also had a group of people, a mob, trying also to try to go to the main headquarters, the main police headquarters in Tripoli. That was when the security situation seemed to get out of hand, and the army had to bring in more forces in order to secure the area. And then after midnight, basically, we had more calm. It was more peaceful. People went back to their homes. There were people many who were injured, including, of course, security personnel who, like we said, had bomb grenades thrown at them. At first, they thought it was Molotov bombs, but then they turned out to be actual bomb grenades. So that was something that was very much worrying. And that led to denouncing from several politicians, including Saad Hariri, who does have a popular street, if you may say, in Tripoli, denouncing violence, denouncing vandalism, and any sort of violence towards security personnel and the Lebanese army. Now, this, of course, is the result, basically, of the fact that we have a huge economic crisis, which has been deteriorating since last year.
Amnesty International has called on France to halt weapon sales to Lebanon, citing concerns over human rights violations. The group said in a statement that Lebanon security forces have used French-made equipment against anti-government protesters, especially since 2019. It said the excessive use of the weapons, such as rubber bullets, tear gas grenades, and launchers, has led to serious injuries. Amnesty International France said its findings are based on more than 100 videos, testimonies, and medical records. It urged Paris to ensure that there are no further sales of such equipment until Lebanese authorities acknowledge what it called their past violations. The Afghan government has accused the Taliban of stalling peace talks in the Qatari capital, Doha. Kabul has also threatened it will intensify attacks on Taliban positions in the militant group if the rather militant group does not stop attacking civilians. Amin Alimi reports.
Almost 3 months have passed since the beginning of the intra-Afghan talks in Qatari capital Doha. The negotiating team of the Afghan government accuses the Taliban of foot dragging, but the militant group rejects such allegation.
The negotiating team of the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan is fully ready for talks, but the Taliban side has ignored to attend the meetings over the past 10 days under the pretext of being busy with their own meetings.
In the meantime, this top army official, who usually spends much of his time in front lines, also accuses the Taliban of expanding their attacks amid condemnations by the Afghan people and international bodies like the United Nations. That is why officials here warn that Afghan troops may intensify their attacks on the Taliban if they continue targeting civilians.
Our message to the Taliban is to either grab the current opportunity to bring peace or stop targeting civilians. Otherwise, we will pound their positions across the country and we will kill them one by one.
Despite all ifs and buts regarding the Afghan peace process, what war-weary Afghans want is lasting peace and an opportunity to forget about war, bloodshed and misery they have been suffering for over the last four decades.
We are tired of war. We have one wish, that is to see calm and security in our country. We don't care about either the government or the Taliban, but we want an immediate silence of guns here.
So far, many regional and international players, mainly the US, have declared their full readiness to support any move toward bringing peace to the country.
This comes as many here believe the Afghan peace process has now turned into a good pretext for some local and international players. This is because such a matter allows them to further interfere in Afghanistan's affairs and follow their own interests in this wounded land. Sayed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
The Yemen Palestine Development and Humanitarian Response Organization has held a press conference in Sana'a and discussed the Yemeni-Palestinian relations. The organization revealed its humanitarian plan for 2021, our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdullatif Al-Washali, has more.
The steadfastness of Yemen and the resistance of Palestinians is the slogan of a press conference held by the Yemen-Palestine Organization. Participants discussed Yemeni-Palestinian relations and their common vision, which is resistance against the Zionist projects in the region.
This event is a Yemeni-Palestinian initiative for political awakening and for the unity of both nations to achieve a common goal of defeating the Israeli regime's plans in the region and liberation of Palestine. Israel is our common enemy and the enemy of Muslim nations.
The participants affirmed that Yemen and Palestine have strong ties that transcend geographical borders, as Yemen has become an important part of the axis of resistance. The Yemen-Palestine organization also revealed its humanitarian plan for 2021, which will contribute to alleviating the suffering of Yemenis due to the continuing war and the blockade imposed by the U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition.
Yemenis believe that the U.S. as the main supporter of Israel is also responsible for the sufferings of Palestinians and Yemenis. They say resistance is the only way to achieve victory and liberation. Abdullatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Bye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The big and overwhelming problems of American society. This is part of a televised speech delivered on July 31st, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Eid al-Adha.
We should notice that the big problems that have engulfed our main enemy is the U.S. government and regime, are not comparable to ours. They are tens of times bigger than ours. In the present time, the Americans have been surrounded by various problems. On the one hand, class inequalities have widened in a surprising manner, and on the other hand, there is racial discrimination which has reared its ugly head, and it has made everyone line up against the U.S. system. Moreover, there are insolvable economic problems. It has been reported that 45 million people are unemployed in that country. This is a very important figure and a strange phenomena in that country. We can also refer to the managerial problems which showed themselves on the issue of the coronavirus. These are the U.S. problems.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Behavior of their cruel police is another indication of managerial problems. In other words, the management of social issues in that country has panned out in a way that they cannot prevent a police officer from torturing someone to death in a savage way and in front of people. They cannot put an end to these killings. This indicates the existence of grave managerial problems which have caused the U.S. to be hated and to become isolated at an international level. The fire under the ashes has blazed again. They might be able to suppress and extinguish the movements launched in the middle of the streets, but the fire under the ashes will linger and will become ablaze again.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
It's very rare that a former leader publicly criticizes or provides advice to his or her successor, and is often something that protocol frowns upon when it's done. However, this has not stopped the former Labour Chancellor and Prime Minister Gordon Brown from doing so, leaving Boris Johnson red-faced in the process. So intense has the criticism been that Gordon Brown has stated that Britain is becoming a failed state, not only through the poor mishandling of various crises by the British government, but also because of the ever-widening and deepening divisions within the British socio-political system. It seems that Brown has placed the blame squarely at the feet of Boris Johnson, suggesting that the Prime Minister is so alienated from the reality in which British people are living that he has lost scope of how British feel on a variety of issues and everyday problems. One of the main reasons for the disparity is the divide between the Conservative Party and the people, a division that's traditionally seen different classes voting for different parties in the UK, with the working class commonly leaning towards Labour and the upper middle class swinging towards the Tories, hence leading to a lack of communication between the ruling party and the majority of people in Britain. One such example of just how divided the UK are as a population is the opinion on Brexit. With such a slim divide between those wishing to leave the EU and remain, the difference of opinion of people across the whole of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and the north of Ireland is already fractured, without raising the notion of nationalism and separatism into the equation. So when the element of nationalism is introduced into the argument, for example, in the case of Scotland, is former Prime Minister Gordon Brown right when he says that the UK is on the verge of becoming a failed state? And if so, just how serious is the problem?
It's obvious that the present system isn't working. When you have one of the constituent nations, Scotland and the other, completely at odds with the capital and the sort of the economic core of the country, then it's obviously the system is not working. A political system has not got just to, hasn't just to represent a numerical majority, it has to represent all sectors of society and all regions of a country. And this current system is obviously failing to do so.
Back in 2014, the majority of Scots rejected the idea of having an independent Scotland, for the country was benefiting from EU budgets allocated to its agriculture, economy and education sectors. However, now that Britain has left the EU, Scots see themselves empty-handed and are highly considering rejoining the EU once again. Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon has repeatedly stated that she would push for a second referendum if her party wins a majority in May elections. Sturgeon has insisted on her country's political independence by stating that Westminster's consent to the move is not their priority, for it's for the people of Scotland to choose and not the lawmakers in Westminster. Latest polls shows that nearly half of the people in Scotland are now in favour of an independent country, a figure that's likely to increase even more as Scots see less benefits flow into their country, and Scottish nationalism is significantly on the rise, hence putting the Scottish people much closer to the option of voting for such a move.
Well, yes, because the last referendum they had was under completely different circumstances. Britain was part of the European Union. Scotland and the Scots were very happy Europeans, and they liked it that way. When Britain left the European Union, they were left, defenceless and without allies in the face of an overweening London capital. So, yeah, they're entitled to ask for it. Whether they should get it or not, is another story. Once the time comes, vote for independence.
Some of the problems that Britain is struggling with in its post-Brexit era and the widening political and social inequality have encouraged other countries within the UK to consider leaving, for they believe that they're better off on their own. Current polls indicate that over half the people of the north of Ireland welcome the idea of holding a referendum on a united Ireland. Also in Wales, people are starting to back the idea of holding a referendum on independence, spelling the inevitable breakup of the United Kingdom in the process. Can Boris Johnson's Conservative government, therefore, reunite a divided Britain? Or has the pendulum swung too far past the tipping point, taking Britain towards a collapsed failed state full of internal division?
Joe Biden was sworn in as the 46th President of the United States on January 20th during an inauguration ceremony that wasn't attended by his predecessor, Donald Trump. The reason for that absence was made clear just hours after when Biden signed over a dozen executive orders reversing policies adopted by the previous U.S. administration. The Biden administration says it will roll back Trump's policies that are harmful to Americans and to the rest of the world. the new president signed an order lifting the so-called Muslim ban. The U.S. will rejoin the Paris Agreement on climate change and cancel the Keystone XL pipeline. Biden has also taken action on the COVID-19 pandemic and signed an executive order to rejoin the World Health Organization. Absent from the announced Biden 100-day program, however, is any proposed reversals of Israel policies implemented by the Trump administration that risk security concerns of a global scale, including moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, extorting Arab countries to recognize Israel, U.S. recognition of Golan Heights as part of Israel, U.S. support for Israeli annexation of the West Bank, and the assassination of foreign figures.
Anything you want to do in the United States as president or Congress or almost any part of government, you need Israeli permission. You know, Israel is the one that allows you to do things and puts a veto on anything they don't like. It's very unusual for the United States to do something that Israel doesn't like. And in this case, Israel doesn't want to reverse any of these policies.
In his confirmation session in the Senate, Biden's pick for Secretary of State Anthony Blinken stresses support for a two-state solution to the Palestinian problem. But he remained silent on the many concessions made to the Tel Aviv during the Trump administration, leading Israel to believe that the new administration's policies won't differ much from that of the former president. In the first volume of his presidential memoir, A Promised Land, Barack Obama writes about the pressure exerted from Israeli lobbies. He wrote that American politicians who criticized Israel policy too loudly risk being tagged as anti-Israel and possibly anti-Semitic, and were confronted with a well-funded opponent in the next election. He added that Israel's supporters in the U.S. use accusations of anti-Semitism to stifle criticism of the regime's policies against the Palestinians. The former U.S. president further hit out at the pro-Israeli lobby, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC, saying that the group moved to the right ideologically to mirror Netanyahu's administration and defended Israel even when its actions were contrary to U.S. policy. Obama also wrote that while congressional Republicans did not care about Palestinians' rights, their Democratic counterparts were, quote, worried about angering AIPAC and losing its support. U.S. President Joe Biden has said he opposes West Bank settlements construction in line with an international consensus that Israeli structures in the occupied Palestinian lands violate international law. He has further vowed to return to the Iran nuclear deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which Trump abandoned in May 2018. In such a political climate, as described in Obama's memoir, Biden will be fighting an uphill battle should he decide to overturn any of Trump's policies on Israel.
Frankly, I think that Biden is afraid of trying to reverse any of these. And why take a chance? Israel's happy with it, just leave it alone. That's the way he looks at it.
Only time will tell whether Biden, who faces numerous challenges both from the inside and abroad, would choose to risk his political career, which culminated in his presidency, by going against Israel's agenda.
On Wednesday, Joe Biden was sworn in as the 46th President of the United States. In his first speech as the U.S. President, he pledged to defeat political extremism and domestic terror.
A rise of political extremism, white supremacy, domestic terrorism that we must confront and we will defeat.
2 days later, Biden ordered the Director of National Intelligence to work with the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security conduct a comprehensive assessment of the threat from domestic violent extremism.
We're committed to developing policies and strategies based on facts, on objective and rigorous analysis, and on our respect for constitutionally protected free speech and political activities. Our initial work on DVE will broadly fall into three areas. The first is a tasking from President Biden sent to the ODNI today, requesting a comprehensive threat assessment coordinated with the FBI and DHS on domestic violent extremism.
The fast-paced move shows how seriously the new U.S. administration is taking the issue in the aftermath of the January 6th demonstration in which pro-Trump protesters overran the Capitol. The National Intelligence Office was created in 2001 after the September 11 attacks with the goal of combating international terrorism. The involvement of the National Intelligence Office suggests that U.S. authorities are examining how to pivot to a more concerted focus on violence from extremists at home.
People in the U.S. who don't want any more wars, who want money to be used for poverty and homelessness here, those people are now going to be cracked down on with the same policies that they're using to the right-wing extremists. And so I think it took a while for the Biden administration and the Democrats to do this, because I think now they're also going to use it to attack people on the anti-imperialist left, the anti-war left, who don't want any conflict abroad.
What happened in the U.S. Capitol raised questions about whether federal government national security apparatus that for decades has moved aggressively to combat what it called threats from foreign terror groups is adequately equipped to address the threat of domestic terrorism. In U.S. Congress, lawmakers passed a measure requiring intelligence agencies to work on annual reports and strategic assessments of domestic extremism. Many lawmakers blame far-right white supremacist extremism as the most dangerous threat in America. Indeed, they have evidence for their claim. A report conducted by the Center for Strategic and International Studies shows that white supremacists and other far-right groups conducted two-thirds of the terrorist plots and attacks in the U.S. in 2020. It says that anarchists and other like-minded extremists orchestrated 20% of the plots and attacks, although the number of incidents grew from previous years. These groups mostly targeted law enforcement, military, and government facilities and personnel. Last August, Michael German, a former FBI special agent, published a report in which it said white supremacist groups have infiltrated U.S. law enforcement agencies in every region of the country over the last two decades. The report said U.S. law enforcement officials have been tied to racist militant activities in more than a dozen states since the year 2000. It noted that hundreds of police officers have been caught posting racist and bigoted social media content. The report said the main reason U.S. law enforcement have failed to respond to far-right domestic terror threats is that they are involved in such crimes.
From the very beginning, the U.S. state intelligence apparatus, whether it's domestic or foreign, the FBI, the CIA, has been based entirely on the enslavement of African people, of indigenous peoples. And so this notion that Biden and the Democrats are going to crack down on racism within and try to eradicate it is kind of nonsense, because at its very core, the U.S. state has been repressive, has been based on colonialism, slavery.
Concerns about alleged relations between far-right groups and law enforcement in the U.S. have intensified since the start of the protest movement sparked by the police killing of George Floyd in the summertime. But when footage of the protest rally on January 6 showed some police officers were letting protesters enter the building, the authorities started to worry. Investigation shows that there were off-duty officers in the rally and helped others to storm the Capitol building. A poll conducted by Reuters news agency after the insurrection at the Capitol found that 12% of Americans have supported the move. With their enormous power, department-issued weapons, and access to sensitive information, police departments have become attractive recruiting grounds for white supremacist groups. Because of the secretive nature of such groups, it is hard to say how many officers are involved. But since 2009, police officers in dozens of U.S. states have been identified as members of white supremacist groups.
It seems that as Britain left the European Union at the end of last year, the inevitable was going to happen to the British economy as a direct consequence of Brexit, with goods, services and business essentially halting their flow between London and the EU, leaving the British economy gasping for air. Add to this the devastating impact of the COVID-19 virus, which has placed the country into its third lockdown, and there's no doubt that Britain is entering a double-dip recession as COVID-19 cases surge across Britain. With the full impact of Brexit yet to be felt until the end of the first quarter of 2021, The end of 2020 saw the British economy sink by some 2.6%, leaving it easy to predict that things will get a lot worse come spring as Britain sinks further into misery. The cases of COVID-19 in the UK has put the country at the top of the global list when it comes to the worst death rate in the world, with daily death rates in the last few days fluttering around the 2,000 mark, meaning the knock-on effect towards the economy is proving to be equally as fatal. All eyes are now on the UK from Brussels and the rest of Europe to study how they're faring since their departure from the bloc, with many keen to show that by leaving the EU, the future does not look bright, and it's hence aimed at discouraging others to emulate a Brexit of their own. Yet Germany, and in particular Deutsche Bank, have looked at the British economy and concluded that three major factors have contributed to the decline, with two of the main reasons coming from the impact of Brexit rather than that of COVID-19, something that the British will not care to admit. So just how big a fall will the second dip be for Britain? Will it be worse than the first one? And just how long will it take the UK to climb out of a very deep, dark and slippery hole that it's found itself in?
Well, GDP will shrink, likely between 5 and 25%. It depends on how long this lockdown will last. And we have now indications it will be, another extension and another extension and another extension, as happened throughout 2020, where initially we were told it was going to be 2 weeks. It turned out to be longer than 2 weeks. So we have to expect most of 21 is going to be a lockdown year. And that will, in that case, of course, we have to look at the bigger figures of GDP contraction, 25 to 30%.
Much like Britain, the EU has felt the impact of the COVID-19 virus. But unlike Britain, the EU has a multitude of industries and services that it can rely on to contribute to the economy, to sway things back into the black in times of crisis. Yet it seems that so heavy is the impact of the third wave of the pandemic been on the EU, that the financial commitments made by Brussels have not caught up with the Eurozone, which could see as many as 19 EU states fall into a deeper recession as a result. Already signs are looking bleak for the EU, with the zone seeing its Purchasing Managers Index, or PMI, fall to below 50 points to 49.1, indicating a serious downturn in economic activity, sparked by the stringent lockdowns rolling out again across the EU. But the EU has demonstrated the ability to work together to find solutions. The 2008-2009 global crash was a fine example of such camaraderie. But with things taking an impact on a much larger scale this time round, will coming out of another recession prove to be more demanding this time round?
No, I mean, you know, that's not any more difficult. The problem is, why are we shrinking the economy artificially by shutting down everything and prohibiting business activity? Why are we restricting individual freedoms, and why are we particularly annihilating small and medium-sized enterprises, particularly in service sector, catering, all sorts of face-to-face type of businesses? Is this justified? Where's the cost-benefit analysis? There's never been any, and it doesn't make sense. And of course, the longer you do this, the bigger the contraction.
The future ahead now falls in the hands and arms, it seems, of the people of Europe as various vaccines are deployed to try and stop the virus once and for all. Yet the sheer logistical scale of such an operation, coupled with the already crippling effect on the economy caused by the virus, will mean that many more will suffer before things start to return to any notion of normality for Europe.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to another edition of the program, Back to Reality, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and my dear guests. Assalamu alaikum, brothers. Welcome to the program.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Brother Yasir, always a pleasure to be with you on the show.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is Mohsen Naqvi. Thanks for inviting to this program.
Welcome. Well, let's talk about a couple of important concepts that some of the psychologists or parapsychologists, as well as ethicists, talk about very much. They emphasize it very much. And that is something to do with ethics. Let's begin with the concept of imagination. What is your definition, Brother Ali Mohsen, of imagination?
The imagination has different, obviously, meanings or definitions in the dictionary. One of them is the ability to form pictures or ideas in your mind. Mm-hmm. That's the basic definition. Whenever we talk about the imagination, this is the very first thing that comes in our mind. That anything that I can picture in my mind is the imagination. It is also said to be something that someone imagines, not something that really exists or happened. So they're going one step beyond the previous definition. And that is, in the first definition was anything that you can see and you can picturize that in your mind.
Yes.
The second definition says that it is not necessary to be something being in the external world. You can imagine or make a picture out of anything in your mind, even if you have not seen it. Or maybe if it does not exist in the actual world. The third definition says like only existing or happening in someone's mind in a real life. Obviously, we know that, you know, when we imagine something which is which does not exist, we have some kind of idea about it, right? And we imagine it. So these are the basic definitions of the imagination that we can talk about. The simple thing is like any picture that you make in your mind, that is your imagination.
Mm-hmm.
That's the simplest definition.
All right. Brother Yasser, what about your definition of imagination? What is it?
I mean, what Sayyid said is correct. Like, mm-hmm. So I wanted to just take it maybe a step further and say that because of the differences in definitions, and that first definition that Said mentioned, unfortunately, has kind of been forgotten. And people mainly go to, when you speak about imagination, they speak about mainly the second and third one, is that you create something in your mind, mm-hmm. that only exists in your mind that you have created. It's not to say that, no, what we mean by imagination does not only mean that sometimes we can imagine something, mm-hmm. that we have taken from the outside reality and we made a picture in our mind, but it actually does exist in the outside world. So unfortunately, when we speak in colloquial language, or we speak with people today, when we say imagination, as Sayyid will probably know, in usul or in the principles of jurisprudence, we have a concept known as tabadur. You can't translate this term. I'm not even going to try to translate it. What it means is that when you say something to somebody, something immediately goes into that person's mind. The meaning of it, the reference.
The first thing that comes in your mind.
So when you say imagination, that person immediately knows it is something that is not real. That's what people think now, but this is not the case.
Yes.
As the first definition is clear, which is the historical definition, which comes from, obviously, from the philosophers, and which, unfortunately, got badly translated from the Islamic philosophers to Western philosophy as imagination by the second and third meaning. What we mean by imagination is not that. One meaning of imagination is what? I look at Sayyid now, I look at Brother you, Muhammad Jawad.
Yes.
I close my eyes, I still have a picture of both of you in my mind. That is also considered as imagination. But you are not creations of my mind. My mind created you from extracting you from the outside world.
Yeah, true indeed.
So this is what we mean by imagination, not something that, you know, I create a picture of you with horns and with a tail and it doesn't exist in the outside world. No, this is not what we mean by imagination.
Yes.
By, as Said mentioned, the second and third meaning. We mean by something that is actually real, that our mind has extracted and is just showing a picture of it to us.
Mm-hmm. You know, there is this important test that has been done by Kohlberg, one of the important figures in terms of psychology. He did something quite leading and extraordinary. Actually, he developed the idea of what his predecessor, the Swiss psychologist Piaget, who's very, very important in terms of psychology, in fact,
educational psychology,
exactly, talked about. You know, this American psychologist, Kohlberg, is very famous for his stages of moral development. All right, he did a test, and his test actually came out to be known as the druggist dilemma or Heinz dilemma. I don't know whether you guys have heard of this. You know, basically, to cut the story short is, you know, he asks lots of kids this question that if you were a poor person and, for example, your mother was sick, she's the only one available to you in life. This is what you have left in life, you know. And she's pretty sick and there's only one drug in the hands of a druggist, and he has like surefire solution to this, to her illness, all right? But that druggist sells this drug so expensively, all right? And would you rather steal this drug or like sell all of your stuff, like house or something like that, to get your hands on the drug for your mother, you know? Mm-hmm. It's really amazing how kids were not confined to these couple of choices that were suggested to them by the psychologist. You know, this is the glory, the magnificence of a child whose mind has not been polluted by their grown-ups. You know, when we grow up, we calculate lots of things. But when you're a kid, you don't have that kind of anxiety in your mind to calculate many things, to say things based on experience, for example, right? But the child does not have that kind of, let's say, conservativeness, all right? So this tells us a very important relationship between the kind of imagination or the power of imagination that the kids have, all right, in opposed to the adults, right? And lots of ethicists, those people who are scholars in terms of ethics and moral philosophy, talk about imagination as being the root or a kind of cause for ethics, as a kind of pillar for ethics.
Well, obviously, imagination is the root for many things. You cannot live without imagination. We live with the imagination. Even, you know, when we hear something, a sound or anything, there is an imagination that comes in our mind. There is a picture. For example, when the door, the bell rings, you know that there is someone outside. When someone knocks the door, when you hear the sound of knocking the door, you imagine that there is someone out there, because this imagination takes you through a process which goes towards the cause and effect.
Right.
To the process of cause and effect, because if this effect has happened, there was a cause behind it.
Yes.
So it takes you there. So everything we can say, like, it is based on the imagination. We cannot think of anything which is out of imagination.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot delete this thing. So if they are saying, like, the imagination is the root for the ethics, imagination is the root for the rest of the things as well.
And what about imagination and sympathy, Brother Yasser? Since you, in the last part of your words, you referred to the fact that you define imagination not in a philosophical sense, but in this simple term, that you say that you imagine to be in the shoes of somebody else. Like, for example, when we are advised, when we are recommended to fast, some people, some ethicists say that this is because God wants you to to let you feel the hunger that is like in the stomach of the poor. This is one of the reasons, obviously, of course. There are many things to it, but one of the reasons being this. Would you think that there is this kind of relationship between imagination and ethics here, and also sympathy?
I think there can be, because if an individual, as we say in English, puts yourself in another person's shoes, this is something we always say, you know, what were you in that person's shoes?
Yes, and how would you do?
How would you act? How would you react? Yeah. And so on. So it can be. Again, it depends on how the person is. The question is asked, will it actually have a result after it?
Mm-hmm.
We don't know. Obviously, tests and stuff need to be done on it. The example you gave of fasting, for example, it is not that example itself is very profound, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala doesn't just tell you to imagine it, He tells you to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So you actually feel it.
Yes.
Hence, the actual, for example, a person who imagines a poor person compared to a person who's actually taken to, for example, a refugee camp,
yeah,
whoever, the effect is going to be far greater for that person who physically sees, you know, and creates, doesn't need to imagine, because imagination has that thing. Yes, you have pictures, but that pictures do not give you the effects of the actual physical reality in the outside world at times.
Mother Teresa says a helping hand is much better than a praying mouth.
Again, but there is a fallacy in that as well.
Yes.
But yes, obviously.
But there is truth to it.
No, exactly. In context, that saying is true. For example, you have a person who has the ability to physically go and help.
Mm-hmm.
And he decides not to help and stay at home. That's different. But a person who has nothing to help, but he says that I will pray for you. The dua of the second person is far greater than the first one.
Of course.
It depends on context.
No, it doesn't define.
It's in the Quran as well. Qawlun ma'roof.
This statement doesn't defy supplication and
prayer. No, it doesn't define it. It doesn't define it, nor does it negate it.
Yeah.
But my thing is that, yes, imagination may be a starter, but it does not have the effect and will never have the effect of actually going to a place to assist, for example, to refugee camps, going to squatter camps, going and helping orphans, going to the orphanage.
Basically, actions that speak louder than words.
Exactly. You see it in real life.
Yeah.
I mean, if that was the case, then, you know, Allah would say for 1 month every day, just imagine that you're not eating and you're not drinking. Or while you're having your tea, imagine that, you know, your stomach is sore. No, the actual physical feelings and emotions, well, even that, like when you see something, the emotions in a person, you know, start more.
Mm-hmm.
It's more affected. Even then, for example, dreams, for example.
Yes.
Dreams are also pictures, imagination. But if you dream about something compared to imagining something, the effect in the dream is more, because there's a distinct physical nature to dreams. Even now, psychologists themselves completely do not understand what dreams are.
Exactly. That's a black box.
Right? They don't want to go into that discussion, because they will fall into, with their understanding of what the soul is, will fall into a quagmire and not come out of it.
Exactly.
So they don't go to dreams, but the difference between their imagination...
They're working, they're experimenting on dreams, but not in the sense that we talk about. Like they basically...
They will talk about dreams, about the mental functions of what part of the brain happens. What is a dream? They will never be able to understand it, because that imagination in a dream compared to me now sitting and imagining myself in a particular island, I will feel something in that dream. Many of us have felt it when you in your dream, when you feel you're falling, you actually wake up and your heart is pounding.
Mm-hmm.
But now if I imagine I'm falling down a mountain, nothing happens to me. Why?
Right.
There's a difference.
Yes.
So, yes, imagination may play a role, but it will never come to the actual physical being and helping and seeing it with your own physical eyes.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's my opinion, that yes, it might not even have an effect afterwards on a person.
But the Mother Teresa, what she said, when we look at the Quran, I was about to mention the verse as well, it is said, قَوْلٌ مَعْرُوفٌ خَيْرٌ مِّن صَدَقَةٍ يَتْبَعُهَا أَذًا. It is said that the good speech is better than a charity that you give that harms, or you can say like it hurts people.
Yes.
You know, today we can see there are many people who are helping people. Or
but as a matter of show-off, you mean?
Yes, as a matter of show-off, or maybe, you know, they do not show off at that time, but they help in a way that the person who's receiving that charity, he feels
would be demeaning.
Humiliated by the person, or maybe amongst the people. When you're, well, you know, today when the these charity companies or the NGOs they're helping, they're making videos.
I don't know
all those things, and then they bring the pictures of these kids. No matter what they feel, how they feel.